ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. After a record number of drug overdose deaths in 2021, the tide finally began to turn for the general population. But improvement in fatal overdoses for Native Americans and other populations of color remain elusive. We'll talk with experts about the problem and possible solutions coming up after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A legislative push to place the Ocheti Chacoin Essential Understandings, or OSEUs, in every South Dakota school has died on the Senate floor. Lawmakers say now is time to change course. South Dakota Public Broadcasting CJ Keen has more.
In what represented a relatively strong push to mandate the program in the state, the proposal was ultimately trounced on the Senate floor on a vote of 7-28. Many of the no's were from lawmakers concerned with potential changes to education and the qualifications of educators to teach these lessons. Lower Brule Republican Senator Tamara Grove said it was a challenge to sit through the vote.
Just being really vulnerable, it was very personal, and you're not supposed to get attached to your bills like that, but I did, and so it was a hard loss. But I'm okay. That kind of compels, it just compels you forward, and so that is why I'm not quitting.
Grove says she believes in the OSEUs and their power to improve state-tribal relations.
My mind was on the exchange students kind of theory of if you know people from across the waters, right, you're less likely to go to war with them. A big part of the divide in the state of South Dakota is because we don't understand each other. We don't know each other.
That sentiment was echoed by Oglala Lakota Democratic Senator Red Dawn Foster.
If you talk to college students till this day, they will say that they weren't aware that there were 9 tribes within the state's boundaries of South Dakota, and how the state boundaries became a fact, and that the fact that the reservations and tribal nations supersede the state as well as the federal government. So how can you know your neighbors if you don't know the history?
Grove says she's now working on a non-legislative push via the Department of Education to further incorporate the OSEUs into schooling. I'm SDPB's CJ Keen in Pierre.
Native Americans needing help with addiction and substance abuse have an option opening this month in the town of Sheridan, Oregon. KLCC's Brian Bull reports on the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde's new residential treatment facility.
Turned out just amazing. We did a blessing ceremony on Friday.
With dark wood decor and soothing tones of gray and green, the Main Street Recovery Facility is spacious and calming. Operations Director Jennifer Worth shows where clients will sleep, meet, do chores, and get wraparound services.
Having full access to counseling, group, case management, any other hands-on services that a tribal member may need.
Worth says any Native American 18 or older can be helped here if they are medically stable and beds are available.
Other things we're working on, hopefully adding a sweat lodge in the back.
Kelly Rao is the executive director of Tribal Health Services for the Grand Ronde. She says like their opioid recovery clinics in Salem and Portland, the Sheridan facility integrates Western medicine with Native practices.
Culture is medicine for us, making sure that we don't lose sight of who we are as a people and how we want our tribal members, as well as other Natives, to feel that they're part of something bigger and that we're here for them.
The recovery center will be taking a few clients next week. Up to 18 beds are on site in an area adjacent to the Grand Ronde Reservation. Part of a major $6 billion opioid settlement helped fund the Main Street Recovery Facility. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Martin Heinrich have reintroduced legislation for essential veterinary services in tribal communities. The bill authorizes the Indian Health Service to provide services to domestic animals. The legislation aims to address the overpopulation of stray and abandoned dogs in Indian country, which the senators say is a significant public health and safety issue. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support great causes like National Native News. Just select KNBA-FM Kawanak Broadcast Corporation. With your support, you can help us make a difference in our community.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Drug overdose death rates decreased by more than 12% in 1 year. That's information from the most recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's a welcome trend after overdose death rates spiked in 2021. Another analysis of data from 26 states by Georgetown University found Native Americans and other communities of color are actually seeing drug overdose death rates increase. That rings true, with previous reports documenting disproportionately high overdose deaths among Native Americans. A 2024 National Center for Health Statistics report looking at overdose deaths over 10 years' time found that Native people had the highest increase compared to other populations. In this hour, we'll talk with drug use prevention and addiction treatment advocates about the realities of preventing drug use and overdose deaths in our Native communities. As always, please join the conversation with your comments and questions. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Minneapolis, Minnesota is Adam Fairbanks. He is the executive director of Anishinaabe NDOT. He is a member of the White Earth Nation. Adam, hello, and welcome to Native America Calling. It's good to have you.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Also on the show today, we have Chris Bruno. He is a cultural coordinator for Anishinaabe NDOT. He's enrolled in the Lakutere Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and he's also a descendant of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. Chris, it's a pleasure to have you on the show as well. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Sean, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. Adam, I want to start with you and this issue that we're talking about today, spike in overdose deaths. Unfortunately, we have talked about this show numerous times, this issue numerous times on our show. Give us some updates here. What are reasons for the recent downtrend among some populations?
Great question, Sean. I feel like, you know, what we've done nationally is really exhausted the available options that we have in regards to medication-assisted treatment, the distribution of Narcan, increased access to, inpatient treatment. And I think a lot of those have really been targeted to the general population. And of course, you know, Indian country is really underfunded when it comes to those things. So it's not surprising to me that, that we're suffering.
Now, fentanyl was a huge contributor to overdose deaths during the last couple of years. Does this mean that there could be a downward trend and that possibly fentanyl is becoming less of a problem?
No, I don't. I mean, not here in Minneapolis, from what I see. You know, we We have a cultural corridor here where we have a very large Native population. And when I drive down into that area, we see large homeless encampments. I see people definitely under, the influence of fentanyl. It's really quite sad, and really, I don't see it, at least here visibly, getting any better.
Okay. And these reports that are showing drug overdose deaths higher for Native American populations, what factors are contributing to that, Adam?
I'm a housing person, housing advocate, and also a housing provider. So I often see for our people, we have a lack of affordable housing. We have really bad homelessness. And so I feel like some of those kind of basic needs that a lot of our people don't have contribute to, the overdoses and the continued use. It's really concerning that, our population continues to struggle to even have the basic things that you need to be, successful.
Chris, you're working directly with clients there at Anishinaabe NDOT. What are you seeing on your end?
Correct. The main thing that I'm seeing is kind of like maybe not like just it is an influx of people with a substance use disorder, which allows me, to use the skills I've learned, both through the Board of Minnesota peer recovery certification, my life skills, that going through addiction myself, and I've also completed a white bison training for a Warrior Down Recovery Project, which just allows me to help create pathways to culture, ceremony, spiritualism. But that's basically my route to help them find that way back on the path. And but it is very concerning to see the growing numbers of the people along that cultural corridor, which Adam mentioned earlier. It's just a continuing process of them cleaning the streets, and there's many other health issues that go along with that, homelessness, and just all the cleanup that goes along with that, and just to move them, to have them come back, move somewhere else for a short period of time. It's almost like the process just keeps starting over, and then within the treatment centers, it seems like, almost like a revolving door. There's people not really finding the commitment, or just that addiction to it is so strong, and having the kind of shell of a spiritual person is a hard task to
sure
help them along with.
Yeah, Chris, just absolutely tragic the way you describe it. Adam, what can be done here? I mean, what do you see that's needed in Native communities to prevent some of these deaths? And are there any solutions or methods that show promise?
Well, I can tell you what we're doing, which I feel is new and effective and innovative. So we are and have traditionally been a supportive housing provider. Just last year, so we started in 2019, Native men initially, We started serving Native women last year. We made a change to our permanent supportive housing model and started transitional housing, bringing in treatment services into the home. And what we do is we essentially, in a group setting, provide education around housing readiness and getting people prepared in order to live independently. So like Chris talked about, kind of that revolving door, a lot of times people will go into a treatment program and get connected to sober housing, maybe lose the, you know, graduate treatment, end up relapsing, losing their housing, and then back into treatment. And that's what I've seen kind of repetitively over and over again. And so what we're trying to do is just create a pathway where you come into a setting through that's transitional. We help you get ready to live independently by doing like a housing readiness curriculum alongside of treatment. So people can focus on recovery and mental health, but then also be learning about how to, you know, abide by a lease and work with a landlord and increase their income to pay rent, and, you know, how to pay attention to when there's maintenance issues and kind of a lot of things that even myself, you know, I wish I was able to have when I was young, when I first got my first apartment. And so we're trying to prep people to be able to, you know, have a private landlord and live in the community independently. And then through a program we have here in Minnesota that is a rental subsidy, we actually move people from the transitional setting into their own apartments. And then some wraparound services kind of follow them. So then they're receiving services in their apartment from like case managers, peer support. And so we are creating this pathway from, you know, youth to recovery in a group setting to independent housing in the community with a private landlord. And those kind of wraparound services stay with that person in the community until they, you know, no longer need the services, no longer qualify for the services because maybe they're making good money and they have a good job, and or maybe they're going to go to school and they will receive those wraparound services, you know, during the time that they're receiving their, pursuing their education. So I think it's really important to kind of break that cycle of treatment, sober housing, and then back to treatment, and create a path from to independent permanent housing. That's what I think is important. And I don't know, every state doesn't have a program to pay everybody's rent like we do. We're very fortunate here. But I do think it's a really great model. And I think tribal nations could, you know, contribute perhaps if, you know, if they have the money to do it, to adopt a model similar to ours.
Adam Fairbanks and Chris Bruno with Anishinaabe Endod in Minneapolis, Minnesota. They're kicking off our conversation today. We're talking about alarming death rate increases with drug overdoses among Native Americans today. If you'd like to add to the conversation, you can do so by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. The college athlete earning the most from name, image, and likeness deals has a roughly $6.5 million valuation. The ability for student athletes to capitalize on their performance is significantly changing college sports. We'll find out how Native student athletes are navigating new NIL rules on the next Native America Calling.
Trickster Cultural Center, an authentic first voice of Native American veterans and cultural arts, will host the 2025 Summer Youth Powwow to foster community relations, youth literacy, cultural exchange, and provide local community resources. Trickster Cultural Center's Summer Youth Powwow is open to the public at no charge and takes place May 31st in Schaumburg, Illinois. More at TricksterCulturalCenter.org/summer-youth-powwow-2025. Trickster Cultural Center supports this show.
I take the child into my arms. I try to hold him near. How do I explain the pain he feels? Well, a mother's gone and a child is lost. Oh, what can I say? Grandfather, can you tell me? pain within my mind. Take your troubles to the river, son, and don't turn around, you see. Oh, nothing you could do could ever change your ways again. Oh, no. But take your troubles to the river, son, and don't turn around, you see. Oh, nothing you could do could ever change your ways again.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. We're talking about drug overdose death trends over the last few years. What do you notice about the severity of substance abuse in your community? Is it on the rise? Is it decreasing? Give us a call. Let us know. We're at 1-800-996-2848. Let's now meet Philomena Kibek. She joins us from New Odana, Wisconsin, where she is the Economic Development Coordinator for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, and she's also a Bad River Band citizen. Philomena, hello. Welcome to our show.
Bonjour. Nice to be here. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to have you. Now, let's talk about this with regard to the numbers and statistics. And I know your work focuses on a lot of that data. What do you see in this new CDC data on overdose deaths, specifically with regard to Native Americans, that's not part of the discussion right now?
Yeah, I really appreciate the question. So the 2023 numbers just popped up on the CDC Wonder site, and I'm anxious to go through them with a fine-tooth comb. What the overall national numbers are showing is that we've really held steady with our overdose rates from 2022 to 2023 on a national scale. But I think what we really need to look at are like the state-by-state numbers. Because in states like Minnesota, for our 2022 numbers, American Indian and Alaska Native, that population group is, has overdose death rates at about 10 times that of whites. In Wisconsin, we have really significant disparities as well. Our rates are 4 times higher than that of whites. And, in some of these states, like Wisconsin, Minnesota, Washington, the overdose fatality rates have been really extreme in the over 100 people per 100,000 have been dying of overdose fatality, where, the overall national rates is in the 30s or under. What's really frustrating to me as a Native public health researcher is the fact that there hasn't been more published about these disparities on a state-by-state level. The only thing we've really seen is like an annual report coming out from the CDC describing the national trends and showing that the fatality rates for drug overdose for American Indian Alaska Natives is much higher than other racial groups.
Well, these numbers that you're giving us right now, Minnesota, the death rates for Native people, 10 times that of the white population. In Wisconsin, it's 4. I mean, that's just shocking. I can't even wrap my mind around numbers that go that high. Do you feel like you have enough data, though, with regard to Native populations, or any sort of lack of data or research? Because a lot of times when we bring folks on the show, they say the numbers that we have give us a lot of information, but we need to know so much more.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the big problems that we have when we're talking about these vital statistics data is that there needs to be an adjustment for racial misclassification, because more often than not, Native Americans are classified as a different race by the county within their death certificate. And, this is happening on an individual by individual level, but when you compile, add things up, what we're seeing is a 30 to 60% decrease in our actual numbers. So when we're talking about Minnesota, you know, with a death rate for American Indian Alaska Natives 10 times higher than that of whites, the actual true number might be much, much more substantial. But the work has not been done to identify how many American Indian Alaska Native people have been misclassified. And so, as a very new public health researcher, I'm stuck with the raw data. It's already showing these alarming trends. And I don't know why CDC and other public health leaders have not invested into helping us come up with better and more accurate numbers.
But what you're saying here, though, with regard to the data, is that it's very possible that the numbers are actually worse than what we have right now with regard to these overdose death rates among Native people.
Absolutely, I'm absolutely certain that the numbers are inaccurate and they're trending down. But we need better data. And beyond those numerical data, we need more research into causation. What is it that is leading to these really significant disparities? Adam, in the last segment, he talked about the lack of housing and housing issues. Absolutely, housing is a big factor, and I see it here in my community. Oftentimes, people are using drugs because it's a survival mechanism. It's really cold here, and we have so many people living in unheated trailers and buildings with no windows. The other factor that we need to hone in on and look at is our disproportionate incarceration rates. So we have in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, in other public law 280 states, we have really disproportionate levels of incarceration. And in general, public health researchers have shown that incarceration is a risk factor for overdose fatality. What we need is more research into how incarceration is impacting American Indian Alaska Natives. With respect to our public health and our mortality, our life expectancy, that has not been done.
Okay, yeah. Philomena, you have an interesting set of skills and qualifications here. You're also a tribal judge. And when we talk about incarceration, I think we also have to talk about the role of law enforcement and what the potential is there for it to in any way curb some of these numbers or possibly gain access to addiction treatment. What do we need to understand about the role of law enforcement?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's been a lot of focus on reducing the supply of drugs into our communities. And I'm concerned that the focus around supply has really motivated the drug sellers to create more potent forms of their substance to evade detection, and this has just ratcheted up the risk for the end users. There's a lot of good things that are happening in law enforcement, especially when law enforcement is directed to divert people who would be using the criminal legal system into treatment, recovery, and wellness. Not enough of that is happening, and certainly not enough of that is happening in states like Wisconsin, Minnesota, where we see this overrepresentation of American Indian Alaska Natives in jails and prisons.
All right. Philomena, I hear discussion about emergency treatments such as Narcan, other efforts as well. If somebody who is overdosing, it could potentially save a life. Do solutions like that have a major impact on statistics? And what kind of promises do those types of solutions offer to the future?
Yeah, absolutely. Having an overdose prevention plan within your community, like working towards naloxone saturation is absolutely critical, especially when we're dealing with a drug supply that is so variable and risky for the people who are using drugs. So in Bad River, we have dedicated a ton of resources, staffing. We've been doing naloxone overdose trainings for almost 10 years. And we've seen a lot of overdose reversals. I mean, at this point, we're tracking these data. Hard to get the data because people don't really want to talk about this stuff, but we have at least 40 overdose reversals every month within our tribal community, and many hundreds of people who have reversed overdoses and who have had their overdose reversed. This works, but it only works if you are getting that naloxone supply directly to the people who are using drugs, because they are in the best position to reverse the overdose. If you're just focusing on first responders, you're talking about a time delay, and oftentimes people are not willing to call the police because they're afraid of getting prosecuted for drug possession or anything that's coming off of the out of the situation. So, our best practice is really trying to supply the people and supporting the people who use drugs to have naloxone, carry naloxone, and reducing their risk in other ways. Not using alone, making sure that they are they go slow when they're using, so that they know what the effects are. They know what the effects are going to be before they go full on. And really, making sure that there is support for them to come and talk to people and get the help that they need, even when they're still out there.
All right. And as you describe it, every second counts, right? There's any delay could be the difference between life or death, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just life and death. It's also brain health. So if we can keep people breathing, have rescue breaths happening as an overdose is happening and before the naloxone kicks in, that is going to that's going to help them preserve their the oxygen within their brain. That's so critical for their not just their staying alive, but their well-being.
Thanks, Philomena. 1-800-996-2848. That is the number to call if you'd like to join today's conversation. If this is an issue in your community, drug overdose deaths or addiction to fentanyl or some of these other very, very dangerous drugs, give us a call. If you're comfortable sharing stories about your community or even your family, you can do that here at Native America Calling, 1-800-996-2848. Let's now get a Southwestern perspective, and to do that we have Harold Peralto on the line from Alamo, New Mexico. He is a certified peer support worker for the New Mexico Behavioral Health Services Division's Office of Peer Recovery and Engagement. He's Navajo. Harold, hello. Welcome to the show. I'm so glad you're able to join us today.
Yes, good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Good morning to you as well. Harold, I know your community has experienced a tragic spike in overdose deaths. Tell us more. What are the contributing factors?
Well, we're like a small reservation, 2,000 plus population, and, fentanyl is... You know, it's It's a real, you know, I don't know what kind of drug it is. It's just, you know, killing a lot of our younger generation right now. And it changes, you know, sometimes there's more potent stuff that comes on the reservation, and that's when overdose start happening. And lack of law and order, police officers, you know, that's a big factor right there, because we don't have any law and order. And this fentanyl, you know, the addiction part of it, it's I don't know, it's just real bad, you know. We still have young ones that are walking the street on our small reservation out here, and that are addicted with fentanyl. And it's just an everyday thing, you know. We don't have no way of they don't come in voluntarily to get help. They won't with this addiction. So that's what we're facing on our reservation.
Harold, I read one report, a 300% increase in overdose deaths. And geez, just to hear you describe it, and I just wonder, you know, what that means there for the people in your community, how that impacts families, how that impacts individuals. When did this really, really take off? When did this crisis really kick into high gear? How long has it been?
After the pandemic, that's when this fentanyl started. Before that, it was just like heroin and other opioids, you know, like. But after the pandemic, that's when it really picked up on the overdoses, because people lost their family and they didn't. The people that are using the fentanyl, they didn't really know how to use it, you know, and that's when it really picked up. That's when the death, you know, the death rate started going up. And
all right, Harold, we did
lose a lot of young ones.
Yeah. I was reading one of the articles, and it was just shocking to read some of the statistics and just some of the stories as well from the Alamo community. Harold, we have to take a break, but we're going to come back. We're going to continue talking with you along with our other guests. And we encourage listeners to join the conversation at 1-800-996-2848. When was the last time you called into Native America Calling? Has it been a few months, maybe a few years? Let's change that. Call us today, 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
When you file online for your Permanent Fund Dividend, every Alaskan can support great causes, including Native America Calling. Just use Pick, Click, Give, and select KNBA-FM, Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Through your support, you can help us make a difference in our community when you pick, click, give for causes you care about. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista.
Through service with AmeriCorps Vista, you gain valuable professional experience and leadership skills while helping organizations in your community alleviate poverty. Find a service opportunity at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. DT Track, your healthcare partner, provides access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare personal resources and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at AARP.org.
You've got it tuned to Native America Calling. Join today's conversation about drug overdose deaths. Tell us, are the resources for treatment or prevention, have they been helpful to you or someone in your family? Has the death of a loved one from a drug overdose impacted your family? There's still time for you to join the conversation. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we've got a caller on the line right now. This is Patricia, who's actually calling us from Alamo, New Mexico, where our guest Harold Peralto is located. Patricia, hello. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Yeah, my pleasure. This is a real concern here. The fentanyl crisis in Alamo is devastating to families and to the community as a whole.
Mm. Patricia, and, what's your role in the community? Do you work in healthcare or social services?
Yes, I'm the community health nurse, and I'm working closely with behavioral health on a couple of projects to just introduce to the families some education and knowledge about, you know, so many people think that being an addict is a choice, a moral choice, and it's nothing like that. It's a disease, and I think the more that people understand that there is hope and we can look at this in a different way, and if you want to put it that way, a positive spin on it, even though there's so many deaths, but we can learn from that and help people. I mean, it's the resilience of the community that we're digging to find here, and so I'm happy to be a part of the community and helping to, you know, find ways to help people understand that, you know, there is help out there. There is hope. There is a better way that they don't have to rely on drugs.
Patricia, we've heard some different solutions in terms of treatment, in terms of the role of law enforcement. What are your thoughts? What can be done specifically there in Alamo to curb this trend?
Well, definitely. I know Harold mentioned it too, the lack of law enforcement. We don't have any of that here. We have no police officers. They need to be educated as well. And we do need to, like, push getting a police officer or two here on this community, because I think that would be helpful too. I haven't heard a lot of the conversation going on, but we have a program that's been started here by our psychologist, and then I'm working with the psychiatrist, and we're going to do, and with the behavioral health, to put on like a community event, a talking circle, so that people can explore their own thoughts about this and how they think that it can be fixed, how we can reach out to the addicts and bring them into. I just think there is just a lot of, I think we need to start like real basic here. I don't think we have the resources at the moment to do big things, because we just don't have that kind of resource right now. But I think we need to start at the basic with the community. There's a lot of thinking like that this is just a problem that's not going to go away. We can't fix it. We just have to wait for it to run its course. But there's always going to be some other drug that shows up, and alcohol too is a problem. And I think we just need to educate the entire community, find out how the family feels, let the families know too there is hope. We do pass out Narcan and all of that, but I think we need to do a little more as far as educating the community here and the families.
All right, Patricia. Appreciate you calling in today from Alamo, New Mexico to add to the discussion. And Harold, I want to go back to you because both you and Patricia have mentioned the lack of law enforcement presence there at Alamo. And I think a lot of our listeners are probably just wondering, well, what happens when there is a need for law enforcement? There's an emergency. Who do you folks call and how long does it take to get a response?
We call Palm Point. That's where the Navajo police is stationed at. But it's like a 2 to 3 hour drive from there, the big reservation, and we're in an isolated area. One of the isolated area out here. This one, Cancito, and Arema, and Arema got their own police station there. But us, we have to wait like 2 hours. Sometimes they don't show up until like the next day, and you know, like I mentioned, fentanyl. A lot of them has to be a lot of these people that are addicted by fentanyl have to go through the judge. The judge has to mandate them to go to treatment. So the lack of law enforcement, that's the real problem here. But when they come out here and then they show up, you know, they send a couple of them. I spoke with one of the sergeant last week. We didn't even talk about anything about, you know, the crisis of fentanyl out here. And so that's what it is right now. They show up, they drive around, you know, they drive around the community, and then 2 hours later, they're already back on the road towards the big reservation, towards Crown Point. You know, they know they have a list. I know they have names of who's contributing, you know, out here on this reservation.
All right, Harold.
But they don't do nothing.
Okay, I understand. Let's talk more about possible solutions, possible treatment. And to do that, we have another guest who's joining us from the Twin Cities area. This is George Green. He's a certified peer recovery specialist for the Indian Health Board of Minneapolis, and he's from the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska. George, hello. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Bujou. Thank you for the invite. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You bet. Well, there's another method that we haven't talked about yet. It's called peer support. Tell us how it works and how effective is it?
Yeah, how it supports and how effective it is. So let me just start with, I'm a person in recovery myself with substance use disorder. And, you know, I've been in recovery a little over 6 years. And I'm also a military veteran. So I also have that aspect. And so, you know, at one time, you know, I had everything, you know, I had a driver's license, had a vehicle, had a house, you know, a good job. And then, you know, I was also in the military, and then kind of after the military, you know, kind of got into some gambling addiction kind of got into financial addiction. And then, you know, things kind of tumbled from there, you know, and then got into substance use disorder. And so, and then eventually became homeless. So let me just share, as a peer recovery specialist, what I just shared about my past and where I'm at now in recovery is, as a peer recovery specialist, I get to share my lived experience. My lived experience about, you know, having it all and then losing everything and then basically starting out over and then having to go through all the barriers when somebody falls into substance use disorder, when somebody has to try to get housing, when somebody has to try to get their driver's license, when somebody's trying to get a job, when somebody's trying to get their kids back. So all these different barriers, you know, including maybe even trying to get food, you know, that's a big necessity too. All these different barriers when somebody's trying to start over after going to treatment and getting into a sober house, all these different barriers. I help as a peer recovery specialist. I get to help other peers or relatives. I get to help them and guide them along the way as they're trying to pick themselves back up and, you know, trying to get reconnected in the culture. So that's a big part of being a peer recovery specialist is using my lived experience and being able to be one-on-one and not any higher than anybody and being directly level with that individual that's in recovery themselves. And I'm just really just sharing my lived experience and helping guide them along the way.
Georgia, Minneapolis, Twin Cities area, many Native people from many different Native nations choose to live there in that part of the country. What's most effective in terms of outreach and just connecting with people who need substance abuse help?
Yeah, what I've found most effective is just being honest, just being real, just being genuine with people, you know, that are out in the street. And, you know, I'm also a person in recovery, and I've also been homeless myself. So when I go to outreaches and go to encampments and things of that nature, I just be myself with individuals or relatives that are out in the street, and I share with them. I share with them about experiences about being homeless. And, you know, I share about them with experiences about having that hesitation to get into treatment. And I share about, you know, all the different hurdles and roles I had to go through with, you know, with treatment and going to meetings and just getting reconnected with the culture. And I share about those, you know, about all the different feelings you're going to have when you're hesitant to take that step forward. And so just really being genuine and just one-on-one with the individual, not really sugarcoating things and just being honest with them. And just another big thing is listening, just having good listening skills to the relatives on the street. And I think that makes a big impact is just being able to listen to people and have empathy. And that's been a huge effect in my role as a peer recovery specialist.
George, today we've heard solutions like better housing opportunities, supportive housing. We've heard about the role of law enforcement. We've heard about just other efforts that communities have taken to combat this crisis. But I'm curious to know, for you personally, George, what made the difference? Can you point to one specific issue or program or resource or even just a way of thinking that has led you and kept you in recovery?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. And thank you for asking that question because, you know, when I was homeless and you know, I wasn't really sure if recovery was going to work for me, what worked for me was going into a treatment setting, like inpatient treatment. And the treatment was Mashkowsen, and that was up in Cloquet and Duluth, northern part of Minnesota. And going from the Twin Cities and then getting brought to a cultural treatment program where I would be reconnected with the Native American culture. There I was taught the you know, how to speak the language Ojibwe. There I was taught how to be. There I was taught the stories. And there I was taught how to sing and, you know, really getting reconnected with my culture and, you know, putting my tobacco out and really hearing the word creator every day and really gave me a sense of calmness. And, you know, because let's just be honest, I mean, being in a city is like a circus. I mean, you got so many different things going on, but so going from the city and going up north and being way out in the middle of nowhere with nothing but woods and being able to also go into like sweat lodges and ceremonies, those really helped make an impact on my recovery and helped me really reconnect with my culture and show that there's more than just being in the city and being an urban Native American. You know, we come from really deep, deep grassroots and we have the tools, we have the medicines. We have the stories, we have the songs, we have the artwork, we have all these beautiful things. And I'm not to bring down any of our cultures or our diversities, but Native Americans, we have such a beautiful culture, and we have so many different ways that can help us on the recovery pathway. And so being at Mashgalzin really helped me reconnect with my culture and gave me the tools and knowledge to continue that recovery pathway after I completed my programming.
All right. George, thank you. I'm happy for you. It's great to hear how well you're doing. And I think the words that you share are definitely going to resonate with a lot of our listeners on the show. I want to go back to Chris Bruno with Anishinaabe NDOT. And Chris, listening to George describe the importance of culture, and I know that you include a lot of those cultural elements as well in your work with addiction and recovery programming. We've got about another minute or so before we have to wrap up the show, but tell us some highlights of how you incorporate culture into your work.
I incorporate it as like something I look forward to doing. You know, I guess kind of being a little selfish with, you know, I get to be involved in these things directly. It helps my recovery as well, walking alongside the relatives and experiencing those together, building that rapport, and just really look for, you know, cultural camps, any type of spiritual ceremonies, sweat lodges. All those things help me in my recovery, and, you know, just to top it off with, I'm walking alongside a relative who really is maybe struggling or hesitant to try these things on their own, and a lot of the people that we work with are maybe not from this state, or so I get that opportunity to introduce them into the community here and in Minneapolis, and it really is a highlight to you know, explore those pathways with the relatives, and you know, mm-hmm. understanding that there's multiple pathways, so if something's not right for somebody, it might be right for somebody else.
All right.
and the experience of being in these meetings, they get to maybe find
Chris, I'm sorry, brother, we're out of time. We're going to have to wrap the discussion, but I really appreciate you and all the work that you do along with our other guests who joined us today. Philomena Kibek, Adam Fairbanks, Harold Platero, Chris Bruno, and George Green. Join us again tomorrow for a conversation about how college student athletes are capitalizing on their name, image, and likeness, and how it's changing amateur sports. Hope you'll tune in. I'm Sean Spruce.
See Renewal's expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. See Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Support by the American Indian College Fund. The American Indian College Fund provides millions of dollars of scholarships to thousands of Native students every year. Tribal citizens of every age and experience are eligible. The deadline for applications is May 31st, and you can find everything you need to apply at collegefund.org. That's collegefund.org, or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Education is the answer.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite.